Welcome, everyone. This is the seventh office hours session for the Mises Academy class, Mises on Money and Banking, which is a tour of his theory of money and credit, and this is being offered in the first quarter of 2012. So as always, for those of you who are logged in live, please go ahead and start posting your questions if you have any. Well, while our participants are thinking, let me just clarify where we stand in the course. So we are getting through Mises. So we spent the first 6 weeks basically doing monetary theory, and then the seventh week, which we just wrapped up, and you still have quizzes you can take, those of you doing the class for credit, is talking about banking. And the crucial thing there, again, is to realize that with fractional reserve banking, again, love it or hate it, so this isn't even people who are who think that fractional reserve banking is perfectly legitimate and is actually economically beneficial if carried out in the context of a free market economy with no special government favors. Both people on that side, people on both sides of that argument agree that bankers, when they grant a loan that is what Mises would call circulation credit, right? So it's created by issuing fiduciary media, that in a very real sense, that loan comes out of a fund that did not exist until the loan was made. And you really, to really understand fractional reserve banking, make sure you understand that aspect of it. And it's a pretty subtle thing. I mean, like I said in the lecture, I actually was teaching, I think for the first time I taught principles of macro, and you have to go through the standard textbook stuff about the Fed buys $1 million of assets, and so now there's $1 million of reserves in the banking system, and the first bank that gets that then lends out $900,000, and then you know that person goes and deposits it somewhere, then that bank now lends out $810,000, and so on down the line until $9 million in new loans are made, pyramided on top of the Fed's initial injection. Even when I was teaching that stuff, I mean, I don't think I said anything false, but at that point, it still wasn't even totally clicking with me that the commercial banks create money out of thin air too through fractional reserve banking. So make sure you understand that this isn't about central banking. Central banking is involved, and you know I'm not even sure we're going to get into that next week. So let me see. If you guys don't ask a question, I'm going to have to go off on that. Okay, but someone did fortunately ask a question. Okay, so anyway, for those people who are tuning in now, post your questions, and that'll help me pace myself. But let me just finish that train of thought. It's central banking per se does not have anything directly to do with the Misesian theory of the business cycle, or what Mises in this book that we're going through is going to refer to as the circulation credit theory of the trade cycle. So what causes it is the fact that commercial banks, when they engage in fractional reserve banking, when they issue fiduciary media, that pushes the loan rate of interest down below. There's various names given to it. You could call it the equilibrium rate or the natural rate. Rothbard might call it the free market rate. But the point is, whatever it is that you think the correct interest rate is doing, that's going to be the wrong rate if not if the bank commercial banks can now make more loans, not because people are saving more and restricting their spending on current present goods, but rather if the banks are able to make more loans because they just decide to issue fiduciary media to create loans or to lend out funds that didn't exist until the loan was made. Right, so that's the genesis of the artificial unsustainable boom in the Misesian framework. And so so that's what causes the boom bust cycle. And then you say, okay, but then what does that have to do with the central bank? Well, and we will probably discuss this a little bit in the main lecture next week, but just to anticipate that a little bit, as long as the government weren't involved, the free market would have strong feedback effects, sort of like a, you know, regulations, if you will, things that would make it hard for any one bank to inflate faster than its peers. And then if you had open entry, you could make arguments as to why the banking sector as a whole would have, they wouldn't just go down to having 1% reserves is what I'm getting at. And so, and then we just have empirical arguments over, well, gee, where would the free market reserve ratio be? And Rothbardi and people like Joe Salerno or whatever think it would be pretty close to 100%. And other guys like Selgin and White and so forth think that, well, no, why would it, how do you know that? Okay, but the point is what central banking does is it knocks down those normal market reactions that would normally prevent banks from inflating a lot. And so it sort of weakens that automatic feedback mechanism that would normally operate. So it's the exact opposite of what the public thinks. The public, if you said to the general public, hey, should banks be able to just issue their own currency, you know, their own banknotes, and have merchants and the public be passing around these pieces of paper that aren't issued by the government, they're not certified by the government, just, you know, Citibank can issue these pieces of paper that circulate as a medium of exchange, and there's no regulation on that, they could do whatever the heck they want. Do you think banks should be able to do that? And we could have 19 different types of paper claims floating around. People would say, no, that'd be crazy. Oh, my gosh, I can't imagine the chaos. And these banks would just be running those things off. They'd be charlatans. They'd be bilking the public. There'd be rampant inflation in terms of these pieces of paper that the banks would just fire off the printing presses. That'd be crazy. We need a central bank to come in there and keep everybody honest and protect the public and the integrity of the, you know, the paper that we're using for our transactions. So we need to go. And, of course, it's the exact opposite. That with the central bank, all of the market's natural mechanisms that would protect the public from rampant inflation and so on get beaten over the head. The government make, you know, the government takes all the banks and basically puts them into a giant cartel. So incidentally, too, this explains why the big banks love the Fed, because normally that, you know, that's a problem that, you know, libertarians get into sometimes when they're first learning economics. They sort of go in the direction of Ayn Rand's essay about big businesses being a persecuted minority, and people typically think that, oh, I bet you all businessmen must hate the government because it just regulates it. And no, the real big businesses love the government because they control the government or they heavily influence it and use it to weed out upstart competitors. And so the big banks obviously profit greatly from the relationship with the government and the Fed. Okay, but now you guys have posted a bunch of questions, so let me cater to that. I see somebody's mentioning that he's having trouble hearing anything in the live events. So, Daniel, I mean, I can't troubleshoot for you. I don't know why that's happening, but I don't want you just to accept that that's the way the world is. I mean, that shouldn't be happening. So if you can email the TA or something, try to get that resolved, because that, if you're tuning in here live, I would want you to be able to hear this stuff. So let me just type that in. I just realized, unless you read lips, you won't even know what I just said. Okay. So Daniel asks, what are some of the unsolved problems in Austrian economics? If you were to begin working on your PhD thesis tomorrow, what topics might interest you? Okay, great question. there's a distinction, though, between what's a good thing for someone to do as a PhD topic versus what would interest me versus what is a good unsolved problem. Like, those are at least three different things. So let me just try to bounce around on those various topics. So, for example, what I did in my PhD dissertation was delving into capital and interest theory with a large dollop of history of economic thought. So if you had to design a topic that would make it impossible to get a job at a tenure-track job at a really good school, my dissertation topic was you know, really fits the bill. Okay, that you get it. So not only was it capital and interest theory, which is really obscure and intimidating and a really hard thing to get into, and like literally five people on planet Earth really know that topic, but then on top of that, I made it like history of economic thought. So it wasn't like I was studying modern banking crises or something that might have some relevance to what was going on in the world. No, I was dealing, you know, quoting extensively from von Bavork and Paul Samuelson and so on. Right. So in the grand scheme, I don't have any regrets doing that, but I'm just saying I was not aware. People warned me at the time. Since this is sort of a off-the-cuff thing, I can share the anecdote. I originally wanted Israel Kirzner to really, you know, be instrumental in working with me on that issue because he was a giant in the history of economic thought and Austrian capital interest theory, obviously. And he said no, and I don't even think you should be doing that topic. He said something like, I mean, if you've got a fire in your belly and you just have to do it, okay. But I kind of made him turn into an Irish guy for some reason, but St. Patrick's Day. But my point is that, in all seriousness, when you do a dissertation, if you want to have a career being a college professor or an academic, I should say, being a researcher working at some university, you can't, how can I put it? I know there's this romantic appeal and you want to say, no, I want to do the thing that's scientific and pure and what the truth demands. And you can go ahead and do that, and that's what I did, and I'm not in academia anymore because I really had a hard time getting a tenure track spot. So, I love what I'm doing right now, and I would rather do what I'm doing now than being a professor somewhere because I get to teach you guys, and I make way more money doing what I'm doing than I would have probably at a there are some academics who make more than I do right now, but I don't think I would have gotten their positions with my background is what I'm saying. So, I don't have any regrets about what I did personally, but I'm just taking this opportunity to make sure those of you listening who are considering careers in academia, when professors who are giving you guidance try to steer you into doing something that's a little bit, I don't want to say hot, but, you know, so, something where a lot of people might be interested in, and so you might be turned off by it because being interested in Austrian economics, it's almost like we attract people who like obscure stuff that nobody else is interested in. You know, that's the kind of people we are. That's why we even give the Austrians a chance, whereas most people say, they're a bunch of obscure people. Why would I even bother with them? Whereas if you're interested in Austrian economics, by definition, you're somebody who doesn't care what the crowd thinks. So I'm just saying the danger in doing that is you can pick a dissertation topic that makes it really hard to get a job. So anyway, that's my little soapbox. But as far as dissertation topics, so unsolved issues in Austrian economics, I really think, having just gone through all that warning, actually the stuff I'm going to say for the next few minutes, I think, is a legitimately open question in Austrian economics that needs a lot more work and actually is very fruitful and could be the foundation of a career. So I just gave you that warning, and now I'm going to show you that the warning might not be applicable. Does it work on the business cycle? I mean, that is wide open. And it wasn't until I just got into it and tried to popularize it that I realized how wide open it is, because, I mean, there's just all sorts of things you can do. Um, if if people are curious, and I kind of pushed this before, but if you're going to go to graduate school and you want to see an example of what I mean, just Google Robert P. Murphy, my heretical work on interest theory or Austrian business cycle theory. Try that. I have a blog post that says that, and I link to a paper that I did for a Liberty Fund conference, and so I went through there, and I gave several examples of how I think theoretically Austrian business cycle theory needs to be refined. So just to give you some examples for those listening who don't want to go look up the paper, for example, we typically talk about, the commercial banks expand the quantity of fiduciary media and that pushes down the interest rate. But wait a minute, in the real market, there's more than one interest rate. So what do you mean? Which interest rate are you talking about? You're talking about short-term rates and then, you know, that sort of thing. So that's one issue, that there's multiple interest rates. And so how do you even give the exposition of Austrian business cycle theory in light of the fact that there's not just one interest rate? What are we talking about? Another issue is the standard Rothbardian approach to decomposing the actual market rate of return on a project is to just break it down into the pure rate of interest and the entrepreneurial profit component. Right, so if in practice, you know, somebody gets into he invests $100,000 into some factors of production, works on the product over the course of a year, sells it 12 months later for $110,000, you know, and liquidates everything and has, you know, so he's turned his 100 grand originally into 110,000 12 months later, that's obviously a gross 10% rate of return. And then the way the standard Rothbardian approach handles that, and you say, so he earned 10% profit, and you say, well, no, there's time preference involved, and so the going rate of interest in this world, let's say, was 4%, so 4% of that return is just due to time preference, meaning, you know, that guy could have taken his 100 grand and bought extremely safe bonds and earned 4%. So that's a given, and so his profit's really only what he earned over and above that, which in this case is 6%. And so I think that's the way the you would typically decompose that stuff. And then, of course, you'd say, as a Rothbard, if the economy stopped changing and things settled down and we got into a final state of rest in every market and everything, and so ultimately we got into the evenly rotating economy, at that point all returns would just be due to pure interest. And so there would be no entrepreneurial component, and the rate of return on every line would be equal, and it would reflect the fact that present goods are more valuable than future goods. Okay, so where am I going with this? I want to say it's hard to take that framework and then apply it to the real world, because what that leaves out is the fact that there are different lines that are riskier or safer. And, you know, risk might not be the right word, because there's this distinction between risk and uncertainty. But, for example, I'm trying to think how deep do I want to get into this. So let me just do it this way. I'll take the example I had in the paper. Let's say there's a guy who has a t-shirt business, and he lives in a college town. It's like Auburn or something, you know, where football is really big. And there's going to be a huge game, right? They're playing their arch rivals, and it's a home game. Tons of people are going to come from around the state to see what happens. But he's going to be out of town. He's going on vacation or something, taking a cruise to Europe, and so he entrusts the business to his subordinate, who is a junior at the school. The kid's not on the football team, but he's obviously rooting for the home football team. And so typically what the guy would do if he were there is he would hedge himself. He would say, one of these teams is going to win, so let's print up either 50-50, or we'll do it based on the odds. Like if it's a 2-1 that the home team's going to win, then we'll do 2/3 of the shirts being the home team won, but 1/3 of the shirts of this batch will assume the winning, you know, the other team won. So the point is, after the game, they want to be in the parking lot with these T-shirts saying, you know, either Auburn won or Alabama won or whatever. Okay, that's the scenario. Okay, so and so they'll just assume the numbers are such that as long as they're careful like that, they're going to earn a return and you know, earn a nice return for their labor invested and so forth. But they're not, the point is, they're not gambling on the outcome. They're just going to take the odds that the bookmakers have in terms of, you know, the Vegas bookmakers and so forth, and so, and that's the way they're going to, at the time when they have to make the decision about how many shirts to do of each kind. And that's what they're going to do. Right? So they're not gambling on the game with the business. And either way, whichever team wins, assume the numbers are such that they can make a decent return. And then, because with the other shirts too, they can like sell them as a joke to the other team so that they can like, you know, do, desecrate them or whatever and make fun of the other team's fans or whatever. You get the idea, and sell them for a dime or something. Whereas the shirts that look really nice that say the correct team won, you know, they could charge $5 or something, or $10, whatever. Because the point is, they want to be right there, ready to have those shirts ready to give to the consumer right after the game's over, and the drunken college fans and the alumni or whatever who are just, you know, had 8 beers, and they come out in the parking lot and they want, oh yeah, you got a shirt already made that says we just won this game, and you know, and the shirt clearly like has the date and everything. And, you know, I was there for the miracle, you know, that kind of stuff. So the point is, you're catering to the consumer if you do that. But since there is that uncertainty involved, they're going to hedge themselves and have shirts of that would work in either event. That's the idea. So the guy leaves town. He leaves the thing that's subordinate. And let's say the home team actually is the underdog. That, you know, they're the spread is whatever, 21 points or something crazy. But that junior, he just knows his team's going to win. He just knows it. He feels it. And so he does a whole run. Every single shirt says, I was there for the miracle in 2012. And, you know, and so, like, the shirt is clearly, like, there's no ambiguity. It's not like they can save those shirts for some other game. Like, it has to be that game. And he's banking everything on the fact that, no, the home team is going to pull off a huge upset. And so then they do pull off a huge upset. And he... you know, and so he sells all the shirts because all the drunken home team fans now come out. Oh yeah, I'll pay $10 for that shirt. This is awesome. This is, oh man, how did you know they were going to win? This is great. I can't believe the shirt's right here. And so the guy comes back out from vacation and says, so how'd you do? We made a good expected 6% return. And he said, no, we made an 80% return or whatever. It would be 300% return. And the guy says, whoa, how did that happen? And he says, oh, because I made the whole batch of shirts assuming that the home team was going to win, and they did. And so we didn't have to throw out half the shirts like, you know, your method would have required. And, you know, because it was such a great thing, people were willing to pay $20 a shirt when normally they only pay 10. So, yeah, look at this, you know. So from one point of view, you would think, you know, from a Rothbardian point of view, you would say, okay, that's fine. So the 300% rate of return or whatever it is, 4% is the pure interest return. They could have gotten that money by buying really safe bonds, and the rest is due to satisfying the preferences of the consumers. It's a pure profit. That this kid anticipated the needs of the consumers more than any of the other entrepreneurs did. He had a product that they want. It's not like he stuck a gun to anybody's head. It's not like he tricked them. The people came, those drunk fans came out of the game, and they were willing to pay $20 for a shirt. And he had a whole fistful of shirts right there ready to go and gave it to him. So that's capitalism in action. And it would be crazy for the government to come and try to tax him as an unfair profit. I mean, he was right there and delivered what the market wanted. What's the problem? Of course that's pure profit. But there's a sense in which that business owner is going to be furious at the kid, right? He's going to say, you got really lucky. Don't ever do that again without checking with me first. Even though, you know, in a different context, if we change the scenario a little bit, where the kid was truly being an entrepreneur and satisfied the needs of the consumers, that the business owner would say, well done. Oh, my gosh, I'm going to share half those profits with you. In this case, the kid was gambling, okay? So So that's what I'm, you know, it's a fanciful example, but you can think of things that are less fanciful, like a hedge fund that puts all of its, you know, 80% of its portfolio is one tech stock or one, you know, one bio company or something like that. And if it happens to hit, the returns for that quarter on the hedge fund are through the roof. And, you know, you're going to say, well, that, they didn't just put it in safe bonds, so it's not time preference. So is it because they satisfy the needs of the consumer? And there's a sense in which, yes, ex post they did, but there's another sense in which they were kind of gambling. And so that's the kind of thing I mean. And so in standard mainstream handling of finance, you have you assume that the investor's utility functions are based on they desire, of course, other things equal to get a higher return, but they're also desire to minimize the variance of the return. And it's, you can't, there's nothing in man, economy, and state that is really easily, that can easily incorporate that sort of intuition. So it's not that I'm saying you need to have mathematical utility functions, but my point is this is a real thing where it's too coarse to just parse real world returns up into pure interest return and pure profit. I think in certain situations, at least, especially when you're dealing with financial markets, there is something about risk that you need to take into account, and that you don't want to just say a hedge fund. Let me put it to you this way. Using a fairly like a naive Rothbardian approach, you would, if one hedge fund manager returns an 8% return and another hedge fund manager returns a 40% return in a given year, I don't think you just want to say, well, the market's spoken, the second guy's clearly better at managing money because he returned a higher return rate of return. No, a lot of people would say, whoa, what was his strategy? How did he get that high rate of return? Was he really leveraged? And do I want to keep my money with him? Because that might blow up. You see the point? So in financial markets especially, a high a return that's well above the safe rate of return that reflects time preference does not necessarily mean you did a great job managing the factors of production on behalf of the consumers. I mean, you did ex post. I mean, so it's not that what Rothbard says is wrong. It's just I think there's situations where that might be misleading. So anyway, that's another main avenue. So in general, let me just wrap up that train of thought. Anything dealing with financial markets, I think the Austrians have a lot to offer. First of all, because it is good, like you're not going to be shooting yourself in the foot career-wise to go into financial market analysis, but also because the mainstream neoclassical Walrasian general equilibrium type analysis that is so dominant in the more standard economic fields, that doesn't really work in the financial markets. And so there's a bigger scope for Austrian approaches to get their foot in the door there. One last thing, too, is just, I don't know if you want to say sociologically or culturally, or I don't know what term you want to use, that's the right term I'm looking for here, but the people who analyze financial markets for some reason tend to be very free market, at least in that realm. So you'll see a lot of analyses, theoretical works, about just pure unrestricted short selling. And like, what would that do? Or you'll see analyses of the futures markets and what's the theoretical, arbitrage-free price of a put option, you know, that kind of stuff. And they're not usually going to then come in and start talking about various levels of government regulation. So for whatever reason, the people, the intellectuals who dabble in these things tend to almost be anarchists with respect to the thing they're studying. I mean, I'm not saying in the real world they are political anarchists, but I'm saying for some reason, if you come in and want to just analyze a pure market economy, that's for some reason the work analyzing the financial sector, that's the standard baseline. Whereas not, you know, if you go to study, if you're fascinated with labor markets and you say, I want to be a labor economist, you're going to vomit every day of your career because the, for whatever reason, the economists who tend to go into labor economics are interventionists. Right? So it doesn't mean they're stupid, but I'm just saying the models that would tend to be in there would typically be about, well, gee, how can we explain why wages are sticky? You know, that kind of stuff. There's not going to be a lot of models showing that there's no government intervention needed when there's a recession. Most of your colleagues will be devoting their prodigious creativity to coming up with models to show the role for government intervention to help workers or, you know, to retrain the unemployed or whatever. Whereas in the financial markets, I think you could get away with publishing stuff that is pretty absent government intervention, and it's just more of a how would a totally free unregulated market work in this kind of setting. Let me say one more thing, Daniel, and then I'll have to move on because other people are asking questions. As far as unsolved problems in Austrian economics, as I've said throughout a few of these earlier lectures, I actually think we don't really have a great foundation in terms of standard basic value theory. And it might just be we had it and then we don't teach it anymore and now it got lost. But, I mean, I'll just admit myself, I get a little bit tripped up on some of these real basic things about is utility and value the same thing, or how exactly does that work when you don't directly value something, but then because now you know it, somebody else wants it and is willing to pay you for it, now you value it for that reason. It is, think, you know, it's kind of like you, once you think about the problem, you can kind of get your footing and then say a bunch of true statements that are consistent with everything else you want to do in economics. So I'm not saying they're unsolved problems per se, but I'm saying there's some stuff there that's not, I'm not comfortable with the state of that area of Austrian economics, and it is important. It's the foundation. Let me see. On the fly here with the camera rolling. I don't know if I'm going to be able to come up with it. But let me try to think of, I had a good way of illustrating the kind of thing I meant. All right, let me just say this and hopefully it comes out coherently. Something like this, that we, something as simple as, does somebody seek to maximize psychic profit or psychic income? And I think most people want to say psychic profit, but I'm not sure that's right. I think you could argue actually it's psychic income you want to maximize. Because if psychic profit means, you know, I choose some action, obviously I choose the action that I value the most highly, and so what's psychic profit? Well, I think Rothbard defines it as, well, it's the subjective benefits compared to the opportunity cost, right, to try to make it analogous to what a business's monetary profits are, but in the subjective realm. But, and so if you do something that ends up being the correct thing, then you reap psychic profits, and it's possible, though, that you could suffer psychic losses. Not that you're necessarily down money, but you ended up doing something and then realize that, you know, I don't think I did the correct thing. And so the opportunity cost of that decision was actually higher than the benefits I got from it. You didn't know that ex ante, otherwise you wouldn't have done it. But the point is, ex post, you can sort of think that probably was the case. And even there, you can never really know because, you know, you don't know if you had done something else, what would have happened. So, anyway, but let's go back to what I was getting at here. So already you can see how we're in murky water. Even as I'm just trying to walk you through this, I'm saying stuff and I'm not sure would Joe Salerno just agree with what I just said. And that's kind of weird that I'm just talking about standard stuff here and it's not obvious that what I'm saying is correct. It could be heretical in terms of standard Austrian econ. All right, but you can see how what I'm saying kind of fits in with other stuff you may have heard that you've read in Human Action or Man, Economy, and State. But anyway, back to this issue of psychic profit. So assume somebody says, oh, yeah, you want to maximize psychic profit just like a business wants to maximize profit. It's not that a business wants to maximize revenue. That's not the issue. What a business wants to do is maximize revenue minus cost. So you want to have that, you know, the gap be the biggest there. You want to maximize the profit. So by the same token, you might think someone wants to maximize the psychic profit, but no. If you're at least if you're thinking of it in terms of cardinal stuff, and you don't want to be thinking of that because you can't subtract things cardinally, but what does psychic profit mean except that? You know, the just calling it profit makes it sound like you're subtracting two things. And so already that's problematic, but my point is, so you're going to do something, and then the second best thing was however good it was, and now if I tell you, oh, you know what, the second best thing you could have done, actually there's another thing you could have done that you didn't realize, don't worry, it's still not as good as the thing you ended up doing, but it's better than the thing that you thought was the next best opportunity. So now what happens? And I want to say there's a sense in which that wouldn't have changed your decision, right? The thing you ended up doing still was the best thing, so that doesn't hurt you. But yet, there's a sense in which the opportunity cost of your decision is now higher. Because I'm just telling you, because the opportunity cost is what's the value you place on the best foregone alternative. That, you know, the thing that you can enjoy because of your decision, that's the opportunity cost. So if I inform you that, oh, you know what, there was this other thing out there that you could have done that you valued more than the thing that you thought was the next best opportunity or alternative, in a sense, then what I'm telling you is when you made your decision, the opportunity cost of that decision was higher than you realized at the time. And so does that really matter? Well, if you're thinking in terms of psychic profit, you know, that kind of makes it sound like, oh, my profit was lower because the cost was higher and my benefit or my revenue was the same. You see what I'm saying? So with all this stuff, I'm just pointing out little things like this. And I'm just to be clear, I'm not saying that if Hans Hoppe or Guido Hulsner or something heard that they'd be like, holy cow, I don't even know what to say. My career's over, and they go jump off a bridge. You know, they might say that's stupid, and they would give you a two-minute explanation. But my point is just this. I see people using terms like psychic, and I think they can be misleading. And there's these things. The fact that I'm even having these doubts says that we don't understand that area very well. And last thing, and then I'll move on. Diminishing marginal utility. Just that phrase, the concept, makes it sound like the first unit has so much utility, the next unit has less utility, the next unit has less utility, and you start doing that, and it... I'm sorry, the other way around. So the first unit has... You know, certain amount of utility. The next unit, now you have more utility than the next unit. You have a little bit more utility, but the gain is not as much as the gain from the last increment. Right? That's kind of what it leads you to think like, but that's not right because utility is not cardinal. Right? So, anyway, just things like that where there's just a lot of concepts floating around in basic value theory that we use to build it up. And I think part of the problem is a lot of it was developed when Bimbavrk thought in terms of cardinal utility. If you go and read, in case you guys don't know that, you go and read Bimbavrk's Capital and Interest, and so he uses examples where there's utility in numbers. And that's how he developed some of his stuff. And so we try to, you know, purge that out, but I think that mentality gets carried through. Okay, sorry that answer took so long, but let's move on. Okay, Peter Serta says, I posted a question in the week 7 questions in the forums about legality of fraction reserve banking. Peter, if you can go dig it up, it'll take me a few minutes to log in right now. So if you can, I'm going to answer somebody else's question. If you want to post it here, I'll answer you live. But it's not a good use of time for me to go dig that up. Or you can just wait and I'll answer, you know, type it in when I get to that. Okay. Let me see. Oh, so Peter says, I'm just asking, is it if I think it's legal or not because there's a disagreement among Austrians. Well, it's legal right now in the sense, do the governments who control the legal system, what do they think? But I'm assuming you mean in a market economy of the kind that I describe in my private law essays and stuff, do I think it would be legal there? I don't know. How's that for a good economist answer? I think I sort of resolved. There was one time when Walter Block and, oh shoot, what is that guy's name? There's a guy who's an Auburn economist. Oh, it's going to kill me. I can't come up with his name. Anyway, he doesn't work for the Mises. He's a friend of the Institute, but he's another economist down there. Free market guy. But that guy was a big fractional reserve guy. No, not Garrison. It was younger guy. Oh, my gosh. Probably the moment we log off this office hour session, the name will pop up. No, not Kaplan. He actually, I think, is local in Auburn. Or he was. This was a couple years ago. I think he might have got a different job somewhere. Anyway, Walter and this guy are going at it at some, there was like a reception or something at Tom Woods' house or something, and they're going at it, and of course Walter's hardcore, it's fraud, da, 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 da. And this guy's thing, and this guy though, he wasn't denying, he didn't really care whether it was fraud or not, he was just saying, come on, and he was saying economically why it would just be crazy for everyone to have 100% reserve demand deposit, and he was trying to show how there'd be market incentives for the banks to redefine what their things were so that they could lend it out, and you know, because it just offended him, the idea that there'd be all this money sitting in a vault not being out there at work, so to speak. All right, I'm putting words in his mouth, but he couldn't see how that could be an equilibrium. He's like, there's no way that could ever be a stable equilibrium. And Walter, the thing that I noticed, because I'm sitting there listening to him, is getting whiplash going back and forth in my neck. But what I noticed is they weren't denying the other guy's argument. All right, so this guy, seriously, the moment I hit log off on this thing, the guy's name is going to pop into my head. I'm going to know his like Social Security number, but right now his name's escaping me. He was not disputing the fraud. So he was just saying, you know, he didn't care one way or the other. He was just saying, Walter, whatever you think about in the grand scheme, if two people can own the same piece of property, who cares? The banks are going to do this, and they would find a way to do this, and their customers aren't going to care because the customers are going to be wealthier this way. That, you know, that was his position, that who is going to object? The banks are going to be happier, and their customers are going to be happier, and what, there's going to be some cranky guy in the corner reading Rothbard that's going to come and say, stop, stop, and he just thought, that's crazy, Walter. That even the private judges, who's going to have the incentive to make the legal system such that that gets punished if no one has an incentive or, you know, no, there's no one who would gain from stopping this efficient outcome. That was his whole point, that this is like a, you know, at least a Caldor Hicks or even perhaps a Pareto improvement. And so in a private legal system, that would be nuts if the legal code were such that this gross inefficiency of 100% demand deposits persisted. So I just can't see that, Walter. I don't care about your philosophical stuff. And Walter was not, you know, he didn't have a problem with what that guy was saying. But his whole point was just, you know, it's a matter of logic. You know, you and I can sign a contract saying I agree to sell you a square circle for $10, but that doesn't mean the contract makes sense. I can't give you a square circle. It's a nonsense contract, you know, that kind of stuff. So I came in and I said, guys, let me try to referee here. Suppose in the Rothbardian utopia, what ends up happening is there are banks that do offer genuine checking accounts, demand deposits, where it's crystal clear, this is your money. You can, you know, write a check on it, use a debit card, whatever. Maybe they issue bank notes that are claims to this. And it really is that, you know, what we now think of as a demand deposit. But, and so that satisfies Walter's point of view, and the legal code recognizes that. but because of all the various efficiencies and so forth, again, whatever the guy's name was, what ends up happening is the fraction of a typical household's wealth that consists in actual money substitutes is really small, meaning like 0.1%. And then a lot of their wealth that colloquially people might refer to as cash actually is in something that is this hybrid that so-and-so is talking about here, Walter. And if you looked at the contracts and stuff, you would see that, yeah, technically it's not a demand deposit. It is a very short-term, extremely liquid asset. The bank promises we'll make this available if we can, but, you know, we might not be able to. So that kind of stuff. And they were both happy with that. So my guess is it would be something like that. So I do think there is something fishy with fractional reserve banking, but that doesn't mean that in practice I think we would have something that looks very much like the current money and banking system, except the banks would all have higher reserves in the vault. That's not what I'm saying. I think, you know, if the government got out of the way and you had private law and banks were able to do stuff and, you know, private mints and so, I mean, I think we can't even imagine how cool and sophisticated the financial sector would be in that world. And so I do think there would be a role for genuine money substitutes that would be 100% reserved, but there would be all this other kind of stuff. And so it's, I'm trying to have the best of both worlds, but that's actually what my position is. Is I think you would have genuine 100% reserves for true demand deposits, money substitutes, where someone's literally storing your money in a vault for safekeeping, but then you'd have all kinds of short-term, very liquid things that, you know, would be like money market accounts now. Okay. Jan says, I noticed you're going to the Porcupine Fest in New Hampshire. I'm thinking about going too. I'm in Europe, so it's kind of far. Is it worth going to? In other words, I found the Freedom Fest in Vegas a bit too formal. Is this thing more fun? Yeah. I'm not saying, Jan, it's worth coming from Europe. I can't make that decision for you. But if it's the kind of thing where you're wondering, is this thing fun? Yeah, it's. I can't wait to go back. And let me just give another plug for it. And I mean, I'm going to be the MC of a comedy roast. So for those, I mean, I don't know if that's something that's all over the world or if that's an American deal, but we, you know, make fun of the people who are on stage and whatever. So it's, yeah, to answer your question, it is a lot of fun. If you want to just be, it's kind of like libertarianism in action. That you see a bunch of people there who can't stand the government, and yet there's not a bunch of drunken fights every day. Like, there actually is a personal code of morality that these people have. And that actually, and you know, also the other thing, too. So Jan, I don't know if you read my Mises.org article, my Mises Daily, on Porkfest. Okay, well, I'm just repeating myself then. So yeah, for those of you who don't know what it is, you should go look that up. And I really did try to describe it. I'm not exaggerating. It made me more confident that a truly free society would work. Like, I could see how there were genuine problems that competition and reputation and stuff were minimizing and solving, as opposed to just, you know, having some central power come in and fix it. So there were, you know, I'm not being naive. I mean, there are issues. There's things like, you know, people come and they set up and they want to sell food. You got to be worried, well, you know, is this safe or not? And so you do stuff by word of mouth and whatever. And yeah, somebody could come and everyone could get diarrhea. And then, you know, well, what would happen? Well, people would stop eating from that person for one thing. But then you say, well, could there be more formal mechanisms to evaluate stuff? So anyway, I'm just saying there were lots of clever people who were, especially because it's not just the one event, but a lot of the people who go have moved to New Hampshire as part of the Free State Project. So a lot of these people, I don't know the proportions, but hundreds of them just live there anyway. So they're like all neighbors, and they interact with each other, and they don't want to go to the government court system if some dispute arises. So they have to come up with ways, and disputes arise all the time. That's the thing. It's not like they all just get together and everything's hunky-dory. You know, I was talking to a guy, and he moved there, and he's got in with somebody and was going to stay, and then so that in the person's apartment, and then that, the guy who moved in, he couldn't get a job, and so eventually, like a few months into it, he had to leave and then go stay someplace else that was cheaper because he had no money, he had burned through his savings, and so the first guy was mad because the first guy said, "Wait, because I took you in, I didn't get another roommate in, and that this was like the natural cycle." And now I got no apartment to rent for a few months until I find a new tenant. And so he wanted the guy to pay him. And the other guy was like, "Well, I don't have any money. I can't pay you, especially with us." So, I mean, there's genuine disputes that happen. And the point is, how do you resolve them? If everybody involved, as a matter of principle, can't stand the government and doesn't want to go through the government legal system. So, anyway, to answer your question, yes. One, I just wanted people to, especially older people, there are young kids who don't agree with the government's laws about what sort of things you can put into your body. I'll just be vague like that. So if you would be bothered by knowing that sort of stuff is happening in the vicinity of where you're staying, then you might feel uncomfortable. But, I mean, it's not like anyone's going to run up and tackle you or anything, but you know that there are things going on that younger kids do these days. Okay. Jan says, can you give a numerical example of what's happening when on the gold standard one country inflates? It has something to do with their exports getting more expensive, but I don't see why. Thank you. Okay. So let's say Britain and the United States are on the gold standard. Right now they're in equilibrium, and the British pound is tied to gold, and so is the U.S. dollar. So it's like 4.25 pounds gets you an ounce of gold, or $20.67 gets you an ounce of gold. And so that works out to like $4.87, if I've done that right. I think that's what it was prior to World War I. So then Great Britain starts inflating, so they start printing up pounds, like to pay for the war, let's say. So now what happens is pounds start... Well, there's different things going on. So one thing is, yeah, the more pieces of paper, British Bank of England banknotes that they're printing up, causes prices in general in Britain to rise, the sticker prices. So that's going to now, because of the fixed exchange rate, that's going to make it, stuff in the United States seem cheaper. And so people in Great Britain are going to start importing more stuff from the United States. At the same time, people in the United States, if they used to buy sweaters that were made in England, now they're not going to because the sticker price of those sweaters is going up as so long as the dollar-pound exchange rate stays the same. So there's going to be a trade deficit. So what that's going to tend to do is push up, so now what's going on? More people in Britain want to buy U.S. goods than vice versa. So what happens in the currency markets? Right now what would happen with floating exchange rates is people would take pounds, they would go to the foreign exchange markets and say, hey, I have British pounds, I want U.S. dollars, because they want to buy the stuff in the United States. So now the pound would fall against the U.S. dollar. So if it started out that $4.87 got you a pound. Maybe now, what happens? It would go down, right? So maybe it's like 486, 485, 484, 483. So the dollar is strengthening against the pound, or vice versa, the pound is weakening against the dollar. And again, that happens because sticker prices in Great Britain are now higher. And so at the original exchange rate between the dollar and pound, people now want to get, you know, the demand. So local people, instead of buying wheat or whatever from an English farmer, now U.S. wheat looks cheaper. And so they switch the demand over and they want to buy from them. All right. So what happens in the short run is the British pound tends to weaken against the U.S. dollar. But given that the Bank of England has that peg, that official thing saying, if you turn over 4.25 pounds to us, we will give you an ounce of gold. And the Federal Reserve is saying, or it would have been not the Fed, it wouldn't have been the Fed if it were before 1913, is saying, you give us $20.67 in currency, we give you an ounce of gold. Once the exchange rate significantly moves away from $4.87 or $4.86 for a British pound, that sets up an arbitrage opportunity where, so in this case, so you know what's going to happen is gold is going to have to go from England to the United States. So let's just walk through why would that happen. So if it moves, you know, do a big move. I'm not going to do the actual rates of return and show you, but just, you know, you can jot the numbers down and do it in a few minutes when this thing is over. So if it's like $4.50 or something, what can happen is you take British pounds and you go to the Bank of England and you say, give me gold, and they give you gold. You ship it across the ocean, then you turn the gold in to the U.S. government and say, give me $20.67 for every ounce I give you, and they do that. Then you go to the foreign exchange markets and you take your dollars and turn them back into pounds. And doing that, you end up with more pounds than you started out with. Because, yeah, right. Because if based on the gold pegs, the natural thing is like $4.86. And so if actually now, because of this change in the trade deficit or trade flows, the exchange rate has dropped to 450, then that means now, you know, you're doing the gold route with your dollars that you end up with once you give the gold to the U.S. authorities and get dollars, you can buy more British pounds than you could have when the price was 486. Now British pounds are cheaper in terms of dollars. So by doing the thing with the gold, so in other words, it's like you change your pounds into dollars in a price ratio that makes sense at 486, and then you get to turn your dollars back into pounds at a price of only $4.50 per pound. So you end up with more. And so that's the point. So that would drain the Bank of England's gold reserves and ship them over to the United States so long as the dollar pound exchange rate were significantly below 486. And then it would be the other way if it were higher. Gold would flow the other way. Okay, why don't we do one more? Let me do one more from Daniel Jepson here. I understand some of the Austrian objections to the overuse of the quantity theory, but I've never quite understood Rothbard's contention that velocity has no meaning independent of the other three variables. Couldn't it be seen as a manifestation of people? Okay, that's a good question. So this is going to have to be the last one, guys, but if you have posted something here that's not in the week 7, if you want to put it there, I'll answer your questions there. But I was a bit verbose tonight. Okay, so the question is, in criticizing the so-called equation of exchange, Rothbard says that V really isn't a a sensible, it doesn't really mean anything. All right, so what he's talking about is that, remember, P, what is it? No, P, MV equals P. I typically learned it as PQ. You could also see it as MV equals PY, where Q or Y, well, Q stands for quantity of output, real output, or Y stands for real income, national income. But strictly speaking, it should be MV equals PT, where T is the number of transactions. All right, so there's different ways to formulate it. And like I said, the one that actually makes the most sense in terms of just the accounting and the turnover of dollar bills is MV equals PT. But anyway, the point is, what is velocity there? Well, it's hang on, so let me just try to get this right. I'm not sure that Rothbard says velocity doesn't make sense. For sure, it's the last variable that really doesn't make any sense. When you say what's a unit of real output, that doesn't mean that's nonsense. There's no such thing as a unit of real output. Whereas velocity, at least you could define it and say, well, it's the average number of times a given unit of money changes hands in the time period in question. All right, so I would have to go reread the relevant part of Man, Economy, and State to see exactly what Rothbard says. I'm not sure. I mean, if you just read it and he said it, okay. But I kind of remember him distinguishing and saying some of these variables, they're not very helpful, but they kind of at least make sense, whereas some of these, like, they literally are nonsense, and they're only like a placeholder in this equation that would only make sense in terms of these other things. So for sure, what happens with V is that, like, for example, the average price level, what the heck does that mean? So it's kind of like the two things on the left side, the M and the V, at least are coherent. You could define what you mean by them, and they're just not very useful in terms of an individual explanation, in terms of methodological individualism. No household to make its decisions with regard to how much cash do we want to have in our cash balances, you don't need to know what's M. Right? You don't need to know what's the quantity of money in society. That's not something that's wrong. And the same thing with V, to make a decision, no individual in the economy needs to know what is the average rate of turnover of a piece of money this fiscal year. So it's not even that, oh, well, you can make an approximation. No, you don't need to know that. So, yeah, you can write these equations out that describe the behavior of the system as a whole, but the point is, if you're a methodological individualist and you ultimately want to explain economic activity as being, the built up upon the actions of individuals, it's kind of weird if you're using variables that no individual ever needs to know about. So the M and the V, at least to me, are coherent. It's just that's not a good methodological ground, whereas the P and the T or the P and the Y, depending on which one you're using, or the P and the Q, each of those is kind of nonsense. The P, what it's supposed to be, it's like the average price level. What the heck does that mean? And the Y or the Q, it's a representative unit of real output. And what does that mean? So that's the problem. And so the point is, if you've got an equation that has some nonsense terms in it, well, then the only way to make sense of the other variables is like if the nonsense cancels out. So yeah, you can say B equals PT divided by M, and so that's really what we mean. Or you can say, what is this P? What average price level? What the heck is that? You say, oh, well, I mean it's MV divided by T. And then, yeah, so if you're going to have the average price level divided by the total number of transactions, I guess that kind of makes sense. But anyway, that's the kind of stuff Rothbard is getting at. And so Daniel, you're right. Like I said, there's two different objections. So one is, yeah, you could, some of those variables are coherent, you could define what you mean by them without speaking nonsense, but it's they're not things that individuals need to know in order to act. And so Austrians typically want, even when they talk about sort of macro things like the price level or the business cycle or whatever, and actually the price level is itself a suspect thing, they ultimately want to be able to relate everything back to individual actions. You know, Mises' book is called Human Action. So that's why that would be suspect. But then there's even a stronger critique for some of these other variables where it's kind of a nonsense thing altogether. And it only even makes sense as involving a transformation of these other variables, at least one of which is also kind of nonsensical. Okay, well, I got to stop there, guys. Thanks for tuning in, and I will see you for the last class on Wednesday. And again, if there are some pending questions here I didn't hit, so I apologize for that. If you want to copy them and put them in the questions for the professor week 7, I will get to them before the course is over.